As we start Deuteronomy, we'll be reading in chapter 15, but before we do, once again, Deuteronomy is the fifth book of the Pentateuch, Pentateuch 5, the first five books of the Old Testament written by Moses. It's the last of the first five books, being the last book, historically, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. They're historical in how they're written. In other words, they're not just this book by itself says this, and this book by itself says something like this. You can follow the chronology starting with the patriarchs in Genesis, running through with the promises, and then how God delivers the people through the book of Exodus. Exodus means exit. They're coming out of Egypt, okay? Leviticus having to do with what? The book has to do with Levite. It's the book of the Levites, which means it's a lot of the priestly ordinances and precepts and things of this sort so that they would understand the rules and regs of the tabernacle. And that's a very important thing you need to know about if you're an Israelite, because you realize pretty quick with the law that I don't keep this and I need to be able to have fellowship with God. I don't know how to do that. And so the third book of the Pentateuch deals specifically with that. But even within that book, which is pretty densely ordinance only, you've got some historical things that develop. So in every book, you've got a historical line that goes through. He's developing things historically. The book of Numbers, why is it called Numbers? I don't know, sound like a good number? Right, there were the numbers of the tribes and things of this sort. There are a lot of things that they did in a repetitive way in the book of Numbers, especially when he numbers the people at the very beginning of the book. A lot of times the book's names would come from the very first chapter of the book. Book of Joshua, for example. It's about Joshua and he's bringing the people in. But Numbers has a lot to do historically with what? Historically. Think about where they are on the timeline here. I've got Genesis here with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and then, you know, Joseph and all the 12 tribes. And then all of a sudden they're coming out of Egypt. Then they're out of Egypt, right? And they're in the wilderness and they're getting this big, dense compendium of what it means to meet with God at the tabernacle. And the numbers, in between numbers, before we get to Deuteronomy, numbers would deal with what? You think a lot historically. Their sojournings in the 40-year time period where they, in between when they, remember, came out from Egypt before they went into the promised land. They sojourned for 40 years. Why? According to Hebrews chapter 4, disobedience, unbelief. Why didn't God bring them into the land as soon as they came out of Egypt? He could have. But something happens in Numbers chapter 13 that prevents them from getting into the land. And that is what? Didn't have the immigration card? What? No. They did what? When they spied out the land, the 12 spies brought back what? 10 of them brought back bad news about the land. It's not a good land. Too many giants in the land. Too much trials over there. And you know how God is. I mean, he's just, you know, he's a hard and exacting man, things of this sort. So God says, guess what? You're not getting to go into the land. I'll bring your kids in, but you're not going. So a lot of the book of Numbers has to do from that point on in their sojournings in the wilderness for 40 years. So God can kill these people off so that their children can go into the land. Well, historically, then the last book, Deuteronomy, Deutero meaning two, second writing of the law, because the first law was written in Exodus, the second book. Get the Ten Commandments and all that in Exodus. Exodus 20, you can read the Ten Commandments for the first time. All these stipulations and laws and case laws that have to do with specific applications of those ten, you'll find in Exodus. But you got now in Deuteronomy, you've got that these people in Numbers who have died off, and now you've got the children ready to go into the promised land. Moses is still with them and says, okay, I'm going to preach, basically three sermons, if you read the book of Deuteronomy. He's breaking down the Exodus law into a rehashing of the law, Deuteronomy, Deutero 2, a second copy of the law. But this time, Moses is giving it to him. He's collecting a lot. He's collecting the patriarchal promises. He's collecting the laws that he's given in Exodus. He's collecting stipulations that's found in Leviticus. He's collecting examples and admonitions and failures that's found in the book of Numbers. And he's putting it all together, compacting it into the book of Deuteronomy and saying to this new generation, now when you cross this river and you go into this land and you're going to, you know, you have boots on the ground so you can claim your inheritance, don't forget God. So that's the purpose of the book of Deuteronomy. It's a preaching of the law, so to say, a second time. It's not just a giving of the law, which is found in the book of Exodus, the second book. It's a preaching of it. In fact, it's going to be this book you're going to read in 2 Kings chapter 23 when Josiah finds out about the copy of the law. And he repents, and they actually practice the Passover for the first time in many, many years. It's Deuteronomy he finds that's about these other books, and it causes him to repent and causes the nation to practice a lot of these things. So what you have here is a bridge here, but he's taken the first four books, putting them into one in Deuteronomy, and it paves the way also for Joshua and Judges afterwards in the historical sections that follow for the nation as a whole. So it becomes a bridge of a sermon of taking what has gone before and begins to give it an introduction porch to what's going to follow after. So Deuteronomy is just not the fifth book in the Bible. You have to understand the historical development and how it flows in the rest of Israel's history. The book itself, what did we find out about the book as these people are on the plains of Moab about to go into the promised land? Since it's a series of basically speeches or sermons, basically, three of them. You can look at it. The book breaks down nicely from Moses' first speech in chapter 1 through chapter 4. His second speech in chapter 4 through chapter 11, which we've seen the first two already. They're very general covenant stipulations, historical prologue in the first section. But when it gets down into the third speech, that section there, what begins to happen in these stipulations, it gets very, very narrow in this. Okay. In fact, this third kind of speech is really kind of underneath the second. He takes the general. Now he moves to the specific and says, this is how you apply these big rocks. You remember putting the big rocks in the jar? Okay, well, you have the big rocks in the jar. You've got to have the smaller rocks of application. See, it's one thing for me to tell you generally, you need to love your neighbor. But it's another thing for me to tell you and say, when people come into the church, you need to greet somebody with a holy kiss. See, that's loving your neighbor in a very specific way, at a very specific point in time, at a specific location. Or you're called to love your neighbor. But this is how you call to love your neighbor in business. You don't defraud them. You make sure that when you're practicing and you're having weights, that you have just weights. See, that'd be a specific way to love your neighbor in a specific setting. And so now what you've got, you take these big general commands, like the big 10 commandments, and now he begins to start applying them specifically. He takes the first one, you shall have no other gods before me, idolatry, which is hammered in these first two messages, first two sermons by Moses to do what? You will not have idols. You're to love me with all your heart, mind, and soul. You're to fear me. So you have this counterbalance. On one hand, there's a love-hate. You're to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. You're to hate idols. And they kind of like a seesaw. They go together. You can't just have one without the other. And so that's going to be the driving undercurrent in every part of this sermon of Deuteronomy, is that they do not practice idolatry. And you can't live in a vacuum not practicing idolatry. You have to love the Lord God with all your heart, mind, and soul. So that's the big rock. The biggest rocks. And so from there, he narrows down to some specific stipulations that they're to follow. We saw starting in chapter 12, we saw that there's proper worship. You can come before God and you're going to love him with all your heart, mind, and soul. You need to worship him properly. There's the threats of idolatry in chapter 13, if you remember. Did what? He talked about false prophets and listening to false prophets. Even if these people were very close to you, you're not going to listen to false prophets or entertain up false prophecy. Why? Because that will pull you away from what? Loving God with all your heart, mind, and soul. So he's taking these big rocks of the ten, and he's starting to try to put some teeth in them, an application, some specifics that they might find themselves running across. So it's kind of like we do. We'll take a section as, wow, this is a big command here, with a big broad stroke. And God says, that's right. This is, you're supposed to do this and loving the brethren, or you're supposed to do this when it comes to, magnifying Jesus Christ. But then he comes in with a smaller, finer brush and tries to brush in some of these things. Same thing with us. We have big rocks that we hold to, like at the top of the pyramid. There's only a few bricks at the top of a pyramid. Those are the big bricks that funnel down, that give meaning to all the smaller bricks below it. But you can't have either or. It's not, well, I'm just going to love God with all my heart and soul and mind today, and I'm not going to bother about the details. Nonsense. And people who want to dive into the details and never really have a heart of love that it motivates from, or Pharisees. They want to sit back and nitpick and say, I've done this, I've done that. I swallow camels, though, in the process. And that's what the Pharisees would do. They would nitpick on the small things, but never had the love of God in their heart. But you find people who say, I have the love of God in my heart, but I'm not going to get involved with the details. Well, both are off the charts wrong. You have to have both. It's a set. And so we saw that the first thing concerning idolatry, proper worship, there's the threats of false prophecy in chapter 13. And what did we find out about last week in chapter 14? Concerning foods, remember? Clean food, unclean food, things that you could eat, things that you couldn't eat. See, why is that important? Really? God's going to tell me what I can eat and can't eat? And we talked about this is how you would discern if you're out in the woods and ran across an animal for the first time in your life and you wouldn't know if it was clean or unclean. He says this is how you could discern. Basically, it's going to boil down to what? What two categories would determine if whether an animal is clean or unclean? What do you think? How it moves, the locomotion of it, and how it what? How it eats. Any animal that eats things with blood in it is unclean. It's just that simple. So any kind of vultures, carrion, things that eats with, you know, blood in it, that's going to be unclean. In other words, you can't eat of those animals. Locomotion-wise, it has to be like a, what did he call it with the hoof? It has to have a certain kind of hoof and how it walks. The hoof cloven, you shall not have eaten of these animals. It talks about the camel, the hare, the rock badger, things of this sort. These are the unclean because of how their locomotion style is made. You're not supposed to eat of those animals. And of course, that's a shadow of what, of how we're called to walk with the Lord and how what we're called to eat upon for nourishment spiritually. And of course, this is in a section dealing with worship, dealing with proper worship. The worshiper must be of such sorts that he needs to understand that he needs to come before God clean. Remember, in the Old Testament, there are three categories of people in the Jewish mindset. And those three categories of people are what? The clean, the unclean, and the holy. Well, I thought the clean and the holy were the same. They're not. What's the difference between the clean and the holy? Correct.
Holy was like high priest to go into the presence of God.
Think of categories and subcategories. The big category is cleanliness. Everybody's supposed to be clean in Israel, okay? But you had the Levites who were holy unto the Lord. They were separated unto the Lord. The firstborn animal was considered holy unto the Lord. The firstborn child was considered holy unto the Lord, which means if something's holy unto the Lord, it's more than clean. It's cleanliness, like Tom says, is the acceptable state before God. You're accepted before God in the sense that you're clean. But if you're holy, you're not only accepted before God, you're dedicated to God, and you must be given to God. It can't be used for any other purposes. It has to be seen as being dedicated to God. That's why, for example, you'll find, Hannah, when she has Samuel, baby Samuel, in 1 Samuel. She dedicates him to the Lord. I want him to be holy unto the Lord. But you see, in that kind of language, he's not just seeking to be just simply clean. On the eighth day, he goes and gets circumcised and goes back home and becomes a farmer. It didn't work that way. You're going to dedicate him to the Lord. He's going to be holy unto the Lord. He has to be given to the Lord. Well, technically, if it's an animal, he's to be killed. In other words, and the reason why you kill him to give him to the Lord isn't as if God's into dead things, but it shows that he can't be used for anything else. And if the animal's dead, it's not going to be used for anything else. So you either kill the animal, or many times another aspect of being holy was that it was turned free, it was let loose. So nobody could go back and take it and use it for itself. Whenever something's given to the Lord, it cannot be used for human usage at all anymore. It's the Lord's. So here's a child being given to the Lord. So it can't be used by the parents anymore. Like Samuel was dedicated to the temple, and that's why he stayed with Eli. And he always stayed at the temple. He's dedicated to the Lord in that sense. So that's the difference between something being clean and something being holy. Something being unclean, obviously, is in a state of not necessarily under the judgment of God because you're unclean. Doesn't mean when you're unclean, you're sinful. It just means that you're in a state that you cannot come into the presence of God and mix and match with those who are considered clean and especially those considered holy. If the unclean ever comes in touch with the holy, wrath. You're under the wrath of God. Now, whether God gave that wrath is up to his mercy and grace, but that's a wrathful state. The clean could touch the unclean, and when the clean touches the unclean, who wins out? The unclean. Yeah, right. Yeah. So if I'm clean and I go and touch an unclean dead corpse, does the corpse become clean because I'm clean and I transfer my cleanliness to the corpse? Or does the corpse's uncleanliness transfer to me and now I'm unclean along with the corpse? That. It transfers that way. So if I'm clean and I touch something unclean, I become unclean. That's what's so remarkable when Jesus comes on the scene, because he goes and he touches people who are unclean and heals them. It's the other way around with Jesus. In the new covenant, it's opposite the old covenant. We're transferring cleanliness, not uncleanness this way. It's cleanliness that way. And that's why the example in the book of Ezekiel about the rivers coming from the temple and flowing through the land and taking out the parched land and all that is from the new covenant. I could go off into sermon here, but we haven't got to 15 yet. But you see the background where we're coming from with this chapter 14. Worshippers should be clean when they go before the Lord. Now, chapter 15, which we'll read, gets into sabbaticals. When you take time off, and this is going to be very, very important, especially in this chapter, when you understand the mindset of the worshiper being clean before God in the sense of what he eats and things of that nature. Now in his traffickings of how he uses his calendar. God's big on calendars. In the sense that, for example, especially in the Old Covenant, we come together on Sunday. It's not written in stone that we couldn't get together on Monday. But back then it was very important on when they got together. And when they got together, they got together. And when God said, time out, we're going to take a time out here, he meant for you to take a time out. Maybe simply, a Sabbath was a time out. And God said, when I take a time out, I want everybody taking a time out. And this is where you would think, well, this is great. We got God taking time out, so we're going to have fun and kind of kick back and rest and things like that. You would think everybody would be on board, but they're not. Because what happens when you don't take a time out, when God takes a time out? You do not fear God. And you fear mammon. Because I got to work, you see. I can't take time off from my work. I have to make money. And especially in this situation where he talks about time outs, when God takes a time out, he takes a real time out. When he talks about resting, he just doesn't say, okay, time out, fold your arms, stand back for a while before we can go back to work again. As if work was the real issue, because I do it 6 times a day. The real issue was the rest. You just happen to be working on the land. What you're living for is the rest. And you're going to see it how it transfers out with other people. So chapter 15, he says, starting in verse 1, he says, at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release. What does that mean? And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor shall release what he has lent to his neighbor. Really? It's going to free you up from all debts. He shall not exact it of his neighbor, his brother, because the Lord's release has been proclaimed. Of a foreigner you may exact it, but whatever of yours is with your brother, your hand shall release. But there will be no poor among you. See, here's the bigger principle. For the Lord will bless you in the land that the Lord your God has given you for an inheritance to possess. If only you will strictly obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all this commandment that I command you today. For the Lord your God will bless you as he promised you, and you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow, and you shall rule over many nations, but they shall not rule over you. If among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. Take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart and you say, the seventh year, the year of release is near. And your eye look grudgingly on your poor brother and you give him nothing. And he cried to the Lord against you and you be guilty of sin. In other words, it's one thing to say, hey, I'm poor. I need some money. And let's see, there's 6 years to the release date. Okay. I could float this loan with this poor guy for 5 years. He could pay me everything back. I'll get all my money back. But the guy comes and says, hey, I'm poor. I need some money. It's only 9 months before the seventh year. And I try and float a 4-year loan with this guy. Guess what? At the start of that release year, all of his debts are paid automatically by God. And I got to release him from it. So he says, don't harden your heart so that when it gets kind of close to the time of the release year, you're going to hold back your money and you won't loan to the poor man. You see, that's the point he's trying to drive home. Because he'll cry to the Lord against you and you'll be guilty of sin. Verse 10, you shall give to him freely and your heart shall not be grudgingly when you give to him, because for this the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all that you undertake. For there will never cease to be poor in the land. Therefore, I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy, and to the poor in your land. Verse 12, if your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you. So it goes a little bit deeper now. I got a slave here. He shall serve you 6 years, and in the seventh year you shall let him go free from you. And when you let him go free from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, and out of your winepress. As the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this today. But if he says to you, well, contrary, he's not willing to go out, I will not go out from you because he loves you and your household, since he is well off with you, then you shall take an awl and put it through his ear into the door, and he shall be your slave forever. And to your female slave, you shall do the same. It shall not seem hard to you when you let him go free from you, for at half the cost of a hired servant, he has served you 6 years. So the Lord your God will bless you in all that you do. Verse 19, all the firstborn males that are born of your herd and flock you shall dedicate to the Lord your God. You shall do no work with the firstborn of your herd, nor shear the firstborn of your flock. You shall eat it, you and your household, before the Lord your God, year by year, at the place that the Lord will choose. But if it has any blemish, if it is lame or blind or has any serious blemish, whatever, you shall not sacrifice it to the Lord your God. You shall eat it within your towns. The unclean and the clean alike may eat it as though it was a gazelle or a deer. Only you shall not eat its blood. You shall pour it out on the ground like water. So what is God saying through Moses to the people here in chapter 15 about sabbaticals? And about this whole idea of lending and not lending and people becoming servants and slaves even. Questions? Let me ask you this question. Why does he say what he says in verse 4 and then turn around and say what he says in verse 11 about the poor? What do you think? Verse 4 is the ideal. In other words, yeah, this is what you want. If we practice this, like we use the phrase, in a perfect world, it's like even Jesus says, there'll always be poor among you. But why will there always be poor among us in verse 11? Because men are sinful, and they're not going to practice the ideal of verse 4. But this is the ideal of verse 4. If everybody practiced verse 4, then guess what? Not only would you not have any poor in the land, God's promising to have your back. That's the first paragraph. It talks about, it says, remember, when you're going to be given to these people, think about it. If I'm going to all of a sudden going to loan this guy money, and then in a few months, this guy's going to find himself in the year of release every 7 years. Remember, every 7 years was to be a year that in the land, if you looked out in the land, you could just turn around and say, nobody is a slave. Nobody's in debt. Because technically, according to the seventh year, all debts are released. And then you had, on seven of those cycles, you came to the 50th year, and that was called what? The year of Jubilee. So in reality, the 49th year was a sabbatical, and then the 50th year was a sabbatical. You had 2 years back to back where you rested. But here in the seventh year here, there was to be all debts were free. And so if you're a guy who makes money off of interest, like a banker, you know, he lends money, he makes money by loaning money on interest, and then I got to release that debt in the seventh year, and I'm going to be having a loss because I'm giving this guy a chunk of change, and I'm charging him 10%, but he's only going to be paying 10% for a few months, and he came away pretty good. His interest rate was really low versus a guy who came in and borrowed at the beginning of the first year, and it took him to the seventh year. He paid on that loan for up to 7 years. This last guy, the first guy, paid only up for a few months. So technically, he got a better interest rate. I lost money as a banker. So God knows that. He says, I've got your back when you do that. I will make sure you're always lending to people and you're never borrowing from people. How's that for a guarantee? So when you risk your capital and you give to the poor, like he says in the book of Proverbs, he who lends to the poor, remember that proverb? You know, it says God will always have his back. He gets it from here in Deuteronomy 15. In other words, you're never going to put God in a box where all of a sudden that, you know, I'm kind of going out on a limb and, you know, God doesn't seem to support me. God says, I'll always underwrite your giving endeavor. We saw that on a Wednesday night in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9. He always says he'll have seed for the sower. He says, here, Christian, your hands should be wanting to give. If you're willing to put it in here out of your resources, bread for the eater now. This is bread that you can eat. Take care of you and your family. But if you're willing to put it in here and make it seed as a sower, oh, you're going to throw your activity in the sower seed category. He said, let me tell you something. If you do that every time you reach your hand in the bag to go to sow, I promise I'll have seed in the bag for you. That means I'm always going to have money if you put that in the bag to be able to give to other people. You're never going to be able to outgive God. And God isn't going to be, you know, playing second fiddle to your giving as if you're going to surpass him in his giving. So he's going to underwrite any kind of activity you want to endeavor with to be able to help and to feed people. Jesus had to teach his disciples that with the fish and the loaves, right? He says, just have them sit down. We're going to, you know, we're going to feed them. We're going to reach in, and all of a sudden there's going to be bread and there's going to be fish. We didn't come out here to perform a miracle. We came out here to minister. And in the middle of ministry, oh, we find ourselves hungry. Let's look to the Lord. Okay, let's reach in. And he gives. So we see a New Testament example of that. But from here, when it comes to the Sabbath year, this whole point here of what? I should not be wanting to give grudgingly, knowing that here's this guy on my doorstep and he's looking for a loan. So that's the first paragraph. We have some people, they get destitute. They're not only looking for a loan, they're looking for a life. I have no money. I'm from the tribe of, you know, Naphtali, and we had hard times and drought, and we have absolutely nothing. And they sell themselves into slavery, or they had to sell the farm to somebody else in town who's wealthier or who can buy them out so they can just have food on the table. And they come to you and they do that, and they basically, you own them because you bought everything from them. They didn't come asking for a loan. They came asking you buy their stuff, and we're just going to be your property. And that takes place. You see in Israel's history, so that he has a paragraph devoted to this. He says, when that happens, what? How are you supposed to treat them? On that seventh year, you're to release them and let them go back. With one little caveat, which is what? Well, be warm, be filled, be gone. There it is, the seventh year. Hope you make it out there. No, that's right. Exactly. In other words, you fill up his trunk of his car with stuff when he goes back out. If he wants to leave, you make sure he never leaves empty-handed, because where's he going to go? He's got nothing to eat. He's just leaving. You don't do that. You make sure he has grain, he has wine, he has the things that he needs so that when he leaves. Now, he might look back and say, I got a great deal here. I don't think I really want to leave. I mean, where am I going to go back to? I've been here so many years, I don't even know how to farm. I'd rather work here as a farmhand with this guy. And I got food every night. I got 3 square meals a day. I got a roof over my head. I think I would rather stay here. And he gives provision for that. Okay, well, then he becomes a slave forever. And you tie, you know, you put this all there in his ear. So see there? Here's your passage. Guys can have earrings. See? Right? Well, he's driving a hole there. Right, exactly. Meaning what? They can hear their master's voice. And that they're going to be a slave permanently. Now, why the last paragraph when it comes to animals? Firstborns. It sets up an intro to really the next paragraph, which deals with Passover. But nevertheless, as he gets into this whole idea of firstborn animals, herd, flock, whatever. Remember, like we said before, they're dedicated to the Lord. They're not to have any blemish. Why? Because not just because God likes perfection when it comes to a sacrifice, which represents Jesus Christ, but that animals that have blemishes were of lesser value. there's a utilitarian reason too. When you offer unto the Lord, you offer something that's going to cost you. That's what David says. I'm not going to sacrifice to the Lord something that doesn't cost me. I mean, anybody can go capture a gazelle and offer to the Lord and it doesn't cost them anything. He said, no, you can't do that. It's going to cost you. Animals that are domesticated are of worth because of their cost value. You have to worship when it costs you something. So there's a principle there that we see applies even into the new covenant. Any questions on chapter 15 concerning this whole idea of what it means to practice a sabbatical, what it means to rest, what it means to have the seventh year, the year of release? Because remember, every seventh year was a year of release. When you get to the Jubilee, it was a time of rest where you did no work. So in other words, it wasn't just a time of forgiving debts, which is what the Jubilee was, but it was also a time where you did no work. And when you did no work, think about it. If all of a sudden I told you the Sabbath, the Jubilee is going to start tomorrow, whatever you're doing at your job, you can't go back to your job, you can't work. You need to rest. You need to stay at home. From here on out, you're going to stay at home until this time next year in December, and then we'll crank back up the business. What's the first thought that's going to come to your mind? I have a mortgage. How is that money going to get paid? And what about the guy who's collecting the money for my mortgage? He's not supposed to be working either, which technically, if I'm not supposed to be paying it, guess what he's not supposed to be doing? Collecting it. If we're all in a perfect world, right? I mean, I shouldn't be worried about what this guy's doing because he shouldn't be collecting it. I shouldn't be paying it. We should be resting. What's the whole point of resting? Is that what? God is the source of my life. That's what it means when you rest. It says in the book of Hebrews, when we rest in Jesus Christ, it means that I'm resting in Him. I'm ceased from working to impress God, to get something from God. I rest in God. And so when they did this in a physical way, it was to show what? God is the source of my strength. God is the source of my resources, the things that I receive. And it promoted faith. I've got to actually trust God for a whole year. And so at the end of that year, when you started back up to work, man, what a great testimony you can share with your kids, right? Wasn't that great? We had 12 months together. We went down to the temple a couple of times, and we kind of hobnobbed with the neighbors and got together and read the Torah, and we just, you know, had a great old time. And, you know, God just seemed to, He just provided. And He even tells them, He says, look, in the years that lead up to that time of rest, I will, like, double your produce. You'll have stuff in the barn. You'll be able to share with other people around you who might not have enough. But everybody will get a chance to eat. Nobody will go hungry. Nobody's going to die on my watch. Now, either God's going to back up that, or He's not going to back it up. You're either going to believe Him or you're not. So if you're walking by faith, you say, I'm going with God. I'm going to trust Him on that. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen in January. It's going to be cold, February. I don't know what's going to take place. But God says He's got our back. I'm going to go with Him. Let's just enjoy the time of rest. The time of rest is the center of our concentration on Him. Let's do that instead of worrying about how we're going to get our next meal. God's in supply. Remember, I'm in marketing. He's in supply. So let Him handle that. And let me go ahead and market how great our God is. And after that year, you can look back, your family can look back and say, wow, God met our needs. Isn't that wonderful? And they could go on to the next time there was a sabbatical. You could say, this is unbelievable. Every 50 years there's sabbaticals, which meant at least once in a person's life, they had a time where they had to experience a rest from their labors for a whole year. And when you didn't rest, which Israel didn't rest, God counted up those years of rest that they failed to rest in. And guess how many years He tallied up? 70 years. And then He took the people off the land and said, I'm going to make the land rest. You're not willing to rest, but I'm going to make the land rest. I'm going to haul you off to Babylon in 587 B.C. And that land is going to rest for 70 years. Because that's all the years you owe me of rest that you never gave me. And since you're not interested in resting, and the land is, you're out. And the land, as He says, even with the Canaanites, will vomit you out. Get out of here. We want to rest. You're not worthy of being with us. And so that expels the people from the land, just like it expelled Adam and Eve from the garden. You're not worthy of that promised land, that inheritance that they had. So anyway, Sabbath, or this the seventh year, wasn't the year of rest like that. It was a release year. And it was kind of like training for the year of Jubilee, if you really think about it. On that seventh year, you had to release people of their debts. So it kind of got you primed so that when it came to the year of Jubilee, the 50th year, you not only released people from their debts, but you saw how God had their back and how He had your back. You could release from working for an entire year, which was unheard of, but that's what God would do. So any question, I want you to see some of the spiritual principles behind a lot of these things as Moses is preaching this to the people on the plains of Moab already going to the promised land. Make sense? Any questions? No dumb questions, especially when we're understanding some of these things in the Old Testament that might seem a little foreign to us in our culture. Last question. So should you practice this on the seventh year? I guess. I'm not sure which Jews. Well, the release part, you bring up a good point, is that when Messiah comes, he will release us from our debts to the Lord. So this carries a spiritual principle. You see it in a physical way, but there's a spiritual principle being released from our debts with the Lord on a 24/7 basis, not just in a seventh year mentality, as if we're working for the other six with God, and then somehow he releases us from our sins on the seventh. But this shows in shadow form that our God is a releasing debt God. So we should be a releasing debt people, you see. And especially in the physical realm with people, in the sense of the things that they owe us. This was to be across the board, because the bigger principle was that God's people was what? Not to be poor. Now, this doesn't mean we believe in a health and wealth gospel, but it means as a Christian, my mindset is that I am a very rich child of God. I have all blessings in heavenly places. I'm not poor. Jesus Christ became poor so that I could become rich. Rich, though, means as I traffic with God, I am not poor, which means I should be lending. I should have a mentality of giving to people, physical, spiritual, whatever I might be. I don't sit back in a corner and say, you're a hard and exacting man, reaping where you don't sow. I don't have anything. How can you demand things? We don't have that mentality. You can't look at it. The Christian doesn't have a mentality of God owes me something. You don't have that. That's sin. Correct.
And Anna and the older man is looking for the Messiah.
Zechariah.
Yeah.
Right.
So at what point were the Jews aware a Messiah is coming?
Well, in what they were looking for, they had a lot of the Old Testament post Deuteronomy, okay? You had things in Isaiah about a child will be born, things of that sort. But that's in Isaiah. That's further down the line. But right here, at this point, you're not given a lot of those details in the book of Deuteronomy. You're given some in Genesis about, the seed, biting him on the heel and crushing him on the head, those kind of things. But right, at this point here, they're just being told this is how you work with people. If you're going to worship God and you're going to walk with God, you've got to mind your P's and Q's and how you deal with your brother, who's an equal with you.
Yeah.
Right, and we read back into this, too, from our perspective. I mean, we're on Mount Perspective. We're 55,000 feet up in the air, going to look back in the valley and see everything. But they haven't quite gotten that, not even begin the foothills of that kind of vista to see that yet, you see. They'll start climbing as you start reading the prophets and what God begins to show them. So, good point. Anybody else before we close? Okay, let's pray.